The world's most troubled countries are particularly vulnerable when a crisis like an unexpected food shortage or a hurricane strikes. And once they become weak or failed states, they can also disrupt the stability of countries halfway across the world. The Fund for Peace, a nonprofit research group, and Foreign Policy Magazine have recently released their 2008 Failed States Index. With me now to talk about it on today's Underreported is Patricia Taft, Senior Associate at the Fund for Peace. Welcome to our show.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get into which countries are at the top of the new Failed States Index, what is the definition of a failed state?
Well, a state that's failing has several characteristics. One of the most common is that that state is out of control of part of its territory and also lacks the monopoly of the use on force. So they have elements of either their military that are not under their control, or they have a presence of foreign fighters on their territory. One of the most basic attributes of state failure is a state that cannot provide basic public services to the majority of its population.
Now, are we saying that they've actually failed or that they're in the risk of failing?
Well, we measure actually pressures that lead to state failure because there's really no clear line that determines that a country has or has not failed. So essentially, we look at the conditions with this index that lead a country to potentially become weak or a failing state, and the degree of those pressures on that state.
And you mentioned some of the measures. What are some of the other ones?
There are four broad categories. We take into account social indicators, which captures countries that are having complex humanitarian emergencies, high demographic pressures like a youth bulge. We also take into account economic indicators, indicators of political stability, and also security indicators.
But there are some things you probably can't measure, like citizen fear or lack of hope.
Actually, a lot of the data that we use, unlike other indices that use mostly quantitative data, we use qualitative data, and a lot of it is gleaned from the media and from open public sources. And the media is actually a very good barometer of capturing people's perceptions and their feelings. So this index is actually unique in that way, in that it does capture people's feelings and their perceptions.
When does a state go from being a weak state to a failed state? When is that line crossed?
Again, there is no clear line between a weak and a failed state. For instance, in the Failed States Index this year, the top country was Somalia, and many people say, well, how Somalia is a classic example of a failed state. How can it have gotten worse? And it can always get worse, essentially. And so they're putting a label on whether a state is weak or failed can be misleading. Again, it's more looking at the conditions in that state or that country that are leading it to severe instability.
And when I look at the top five, there are no surprises on the list: Somalia, Sudan, Zimbabwe, Chad, Iraq. But I was surprised that Burma is not even in the top 10. In fact, it was tied with Bangladesh for 12th place.
Well, how the index is compiled is that we essentially we measure a country for the 6 months of the prior year. So actually the current cyclone that hit Burma and so on was not part of this index. So the current crisis in Burma will certainly show up on the 2009 Failed States Index, and we certainly captured the political crackdown that happened in September 2007. But that's why Burma's not higher on the list.
And I was surprised to note that Israel has made the top 50 for the first time. Mm-hmm. What has led that to happen?
Generally, Israel's instability this year is due to two main factors. When we look at Israel, we're also our definition of a state is as the United Nations defines a state. So Israel, in and of itself, also includes we're also measuring the crisis actually in the West Bank. So a lot of that has been fueled by the deadlock between Fatah and Hamas in the West Bank and the growing humanitarian emergency there, but also it's reflective of general instability in Israel proper itself, which has been characterized by the corruption scandal, and just generally it's now becoming more more and more about, less about Arab on Israeli violence and a lot more about Arab on Arab violence and also just general instability in Israel itself.
On the other hand, Israel is still a pretty stable democracy. So can a failed state be failed according to the index but strong in other ways?
Well, actually, the title is misleading. These are not necessarily failed states. Again, they're states that are at risk for violent conflict. But there are certain countries, certainly, that are on the list. Israel is one of them. There are others that are showing signs of weaknesses, but in all other ways are strong, stable democracies.
It's interesting that the five states at the top were the five states at the top last year, but in a different order.
Right.
And four of them are in Africa.
Yes, unfortunately. Most of the states in the top 10 are in Africa, and that has been the case for the past 4 years.
I was surprised that not one state in Africa is considered totally stable, not even South Africa or Botswana.
A lot of that is because in Africa, essentially, when a state fails, it tends to pull in all of its neighbors. South Africa traditionally is thought of in sub-Saharan Africa as being one of the most stable, but it's suffering from the crisis of its neighbor, Zimbabwe, with thousands and thousands of refugees trying to cross the border into South Africa. And we've recently seen that there's been a spike in xenophobia in South Africa and so on. So this is really an example of how one failing state can really pull in everyone around it.
Do all of the most failed states have anything in common? Obviously not having a dictator. Some of them do, but Somalia doesn't and Iraq doesn't in the list that you have here.
Essentially, again, it goes back to the definition of what a failed state is. What they, again, have in common is that most of them are basically unable to control a portion of their territory, and in most cases, these states cannot provide or will not provide public services to its citizens. But there's no cookie-cutter characteristic of a failed state. They tend to possess certain attributes.
Last year, Sudan was number one on the list. Now it's been replaced, in fact, by Somalia. It's my sense that Sudan hasn't improved. It's just that Somalia has gotten worse?
Exactly. For instance, in Somalia last year, essentially there's 70,000 people fled from the capital of Mogadishu. So an entire capital city of a country was essentially emptied because of the violence happening there. And Sudan tends to get a lot of attention, of course, because of the humanitarian disaster that's happening in Darfur. And I think Somalia suffers a bit of that because people think, well, with Somalia, of course, it's all of these horrible things are happening and it can't get any worse. But when you have 70,000 people fleeing from a capital city, trying to think of having that happen in Washington, D.C., comparably, it just shows you the nature of the ongoing crisis in Somalia.
I'm talking with Patricia Taft, who's a senior associate at the Fund for Peace. The Fund for Peace and also Foreign Policy Magazine have just recently released their 2008 Failed States Index. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. Iraq was number two last year, and now it's number five. Should I be encouraged by that?
Well, actually, the improvement in Iraq score stems largely from the changed security environment because of the surge. But nevertheless, Iraq obviously is still far from stable. And essentially, there is even though it had a temporary lull in the violence because of the increase in U.S. forces, the five brigades that were sent in, there still hasn't really been meaningful progress at the political level. And any really real progress, I would say, at national reconciliation. So security in and of itself, while it may be foretelling in the short term, it's without political cooperation and general efforts at reconciliation, it really is only a short-term game.
Isn't one of your specialties looking into how state fragility can contribute to terrorist acquisitions of a weapon of mass destruction?
Yes, actually, we have a project called Threat Convergence that looks at just that. That looks at how state failure essentially can play host to these areas where weapons can be proliferated and where certainly terrorists and other unsavory actors kind of have a safe place to meet to do just that. And And the classic obvious example of that is what happened in Afghanistan. But it's certainly not contained to just a state that's failed or a state that's weak. It's also areas and states that the government doesn't have control over.
It also can lead to governments of failing states wanting to acquire more weapons.
Certainly.
To hold on to power.
Absolutely. Certainly see that obviously Pakistan and India are both nuclear-armed states, but certainly with the AQ Khan case that happened a couple of years ago, you could see how serious this issue is, and with Iran, obviously, another current example.
Which fragile states are you most concerned about when it comes to acquiring weapons of mass destruction?
It's not what's more worrisome now is not the trend of states wanting to acquire WMDs. It's actually non-state actors. So it's actually terrorist groups, and there's been quite a bit of evidence that Al Qaeda has certainly showed interest in that in the past. And so it's less about states are easier to control in a certain way, but certainly non-state actors and terrorists and criminal entities and so on, they operate in spaces that aren't so easily defined.
So we see that in Pakistan, and we're seeing that again in Afghanistan. Where is Afghanistan on the list?
Afghanistan this year?
Because we're seeing quite a bit of instability there again, resurgence of the Taliban, as you said.
Right. Afghanistan's number 7 on the list. Mm. And it is over 2007, it certainly was getting worse and not better. And it is a resurgence of the Taliban. It's also an explosion in poppy production feeding into the opium trade. And again, the Taliban prior to 2007 was mostly concentrated in the Taliban and Al Qaeda efforts are mostly concentrated on the border with Pakistan in the south, and now we're seeing that it spread to other parts of the country.
It was interesting to note that Bangladesh is the country that suffered the worst decline from last year's index.
Yes.
Why?
Well, a lot of it had to do, of course, with the cyclone that hit late last year. But Bangladesh has also, beyond environmental pressures, Bangladesh is also, there was a 18-month state of emergency imposed. It's growing. There's a growing concern over Islamic extremism. It is just a country that is under severe pressure right now, and the environmental pressure is only making the political and social pressures worse.
So environmental factors can lead to instability.
Certainly, environmental factors in areas obviously feature food scarcity, and food scarcity is obviously shown to lead to conflict. In general, resource scarcity. So environment certainly plays a role in state weakness.
In fact, just yesterday, the chairman of the National Intelligence Council told Congress that climate change could become a big security risk for the United States, that global warming could destabilize struggling countries around the world and create breeding grounds for terrorism. But it's interesting that it comes out of the same government that in different agencies denies that there is such a thing as climate change.
Well, of course, that's a very hot topic and hot debate, but I think that at least from my perspective and the perspective of the Fund for Peace, certainly climate change is creating a global crisis, and certainly you can see that manifest itself most apparently in Africa. And it also fuels into the whole debate about biofuels and so on, but I would definitely say that climate change is a real thing.
And you mentioned biofuels. What impact have rising oil prices and the rising food costs that we've been hearing about had on the stability of these countries?
Well, food and oil prices are intertwined. I think the push for biofuels, as I mentioned, has increased the demand for palm oil and corn, which is part of what helped to drive food prices. And also, the production of oil doesn't necessarily have to destabilize a country, but in a country that has a weak government, corruption is always the issue, and with oil prices, as they are now, the stakes are even higher, because the expectations of people that the resources, that they're going to benefit from the resources from high oil prices are often not met. And it also increases the likelihood that there will be coups and other instability as groups compete to try to gain control over those resources.
In your world map that shows where failed states are, it's clear that certain failed states and endangered states are clustered together.
Yes.
So one will just have an impact on the other? Is that because of refugees or because political instability in a neighbor leads to political instability in your country?
Pretty much all of those things. We call these regions of instability, and again, unfortunately, those are most apparent in Africa. But it does have to do with refugee crisis. It also has to do with affinity groups, like we're seeing in the crisis between Chad and Sudan. Also, what we saw in West Africa a few years ago, when certain ethnicities living across artificially imposed borders. That's another big one. Again, that also is the case in the Balkans. But oftentimes when states fail, they do tend to pull down the whole neighborhood.
Also on the world map of the failed states versus stable states, there seems to be a clear correlation between geography and stability. Most of the failed or endangered states seem to be clustered around the equator. Most of the stable states are in the northern or southern extremes of the globe. So geography is a real factor here? Temperate zone somehow leads to stability?
Not necessarily. I mean, Russia can be bitterly cold, and it continues to remain on the brink of the top 60 due to lack of political freedoms. There are also countries like Singapore and Uruguay that are firmly in the tropics, but enjoy, you know, fairly respectable scores.
So, but why do you think so many of the successful states in the index are Finland, Sweden, Ireland, Switzerland, Iceland, New Zealand, Denmark, Australia, Austria, all in temperate areas? And why Scandinavia? Why does it, as an area, tend to be so stable?
Well, a lot of it has to do with these countries are fairly homogenous. And also the nature of the leadership and the economy is in these countries, the Scandinavian countries in particular, is to basically reduce any inequality that exists. And they create, you know, numerous social welfare programs and essentially prevent social and economic pressures from developing. This isn't to say that everything's perfect, but from a state failure standpoint, there's no systematic weaknesses in those countries.
Well, we are in a temperate area, the United States. Where do we come on these lists?
We are actually at 161 out of 177. We're between the United Kingdom and Portugal. And we fare, you know, obviously pretty well, but we certainly have our areas of weakness. One of the you know, classic ones from last year's index was what happened to the United States in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. But certainly I wouldn't say that the United States is perfectly stable, but we do have a strong government, and we have strong state institutions that are able to manage weaknesses and pressures on the United States, so we don't, you know, implode into conflict like you see in Sudan or in Zimbabwe.
But despite those ambiguities, the United States always plays a role in dealing with weak and failing states, trying to stabilize some. Some would argue that we've also been responsible for destabilizing some of the states.
Certainly. I think one of the biggest lessons after September 11th is that we, the United States, and we, the world, but in particular, we, the United States, can't ignore failed states and certainly the threats that emanate from them. And of course, there's the argument that the United States has done more to destabilize certain countries than with the intention of creating stability. But I think our general policy when it comes to weak and failed states these days is to pay attention and try to help stabilize, whether economically or militarily or so on.
Once a state is on the failed state list, what are the chances that it will get off the list entirely, not come back in the near future?
It takes a while for a state that is perhaps in the, you know, top 10 or top 20 in the failed states index to come off of the index, basically because the reason that they're there is it's been, you know, so many decades or years of endemic state weakness that have put them there. But there have been states that, you know, that have managed to pull themselves back from the brink on this year's index. Liberia is one of them. Haiti, you know, long thought the basket case of the Western Hemisphere and a, you know, poster child of a failed state, has managed to make, you know, some improvements.
And Ivory Coast as well, because of the peace agreement.
Ivory Coast as well because of the peace agreement, and also because there's, you know, a fairly large presence of United Nations peacekeepers there. And it's been an interesting success story.
In the case of Liberia, it seems to be largely because of the efforts of President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf.
Absolutely.
Although I guess she was elected because people wanted to see that change.
I think in Liberia, what we had a case of, as far as the population, is there was a general sense of war weariness. People were tired after decades of war, and really they wanted peace. They were tired, and so there was a certain push on the part of the population. And certainly, President Sirleaf is an amazing success story. She went in and tackled Liberia's corruption almost immediately, and she really addressed the very things that Liberia needed at the time. And again, there is a fairly sizable peacekeeping mission in Liberia as well, and that's providing a degree of security so that President Sirleaf was able to attack or address some of the endemic social problems.
Do you ever worry that a country's problems may be exacerbated by being put on the failed states index?
We receive that question a lot, and the answer simply is that we hope by the country being on the failed states index, it causes them to essentially, and it has in certain cases, examine what their areas of weakness are. In one case, in Moldova, actually, they were made the list, and the government actually formed a task force to look at essentially what we had pointed out were weaknesses in the country of Moldova. So this is less about getting a state to be oppose to child as a bad state, and more about trying to encourage states and states with responsible leadership to essentially examine why they may be on the list.
Well, Moldova was a center of quite a bit of criminal activity. Have they eliminated that?
Well, Moldova itself is suffering from one of the key attributes of state weakness. It has an entire region, Transnistria, that's completely out of its control. But Moldova is certainly improving, and it's a state that is kind of emblematic of that entire area of Eastern Europe. And so post-Soviet space, where essentially these states are coming along slowly but surely, but Moldova still is certainly experiences high levels of criminality. But luckily, they're being pulled in by the European Union and so on. So I have higher hopes for Moldova than I do for some other states.
Now, Patricia, you have, in the past 5 years, co-led field missions to more than 30 countries to study responses to humanitarian disasters. Out of all the disasters you've studied, is there one that you're most concerned about?
I think I'm most concerned right now with what's happening in Sudan, of course, and also what's happening in Zimbabwe. I think we have a general powder keg there, and again, as mentioned earlier, it's certainly affecting the stability of South Africa, and it's also actually affecting the stability of all of Southern Africa. So from a purely looking at it from a as a diagnosis of the state that is most concerned, I would say right now Zimbabwe is pretty near the top of at least my list.
And it's shocking that more isn't being done. Do you see any kind of resolution in Zimbabwe other than somebody going in and forcibly removing Robert Mugabe from the seat of government?
Well, obviously we don't advocate personally removing any leader, but I think I'm beginning to see more being done. Nelson Mandela actually just came out, I believe, yesterday with some fairly harsh words for Mugabe. And I think really it's going to depend on leaders of strong African countries or other African countries to really put pressure on him to step down. And that's such a problem in Africa because many of these, like Mugabe and so on, are revered as liberators and men who freed Africa from colonialism. So there's a general reluctance on the part of other African leaders to kind of speak up. But I'm seeing more and more in the news that's kind of fading away.
Well, people were disappointed that Nelson Mandela's successor, Thabo Mbeki, has done so little, if anything, seems to be propping up the Mugabe regime. By the way, we have a link to the 2008 Failed States Index posted on our show page at WNYC.org if listeners want to read all of the rankings. When did this start? When did Fund for Peace and Foreign Policy magazine start doing this?
The first Failed States Index was 4 years ago. So this is the 2008 is the fourth one. So the first one was produced in 2004.
And had anybody done anything like this before?
Indices are fairly a hot thing right now. A lot of people are producing indices, but no, this is the first index of states that are vulnerable to collapse.
Is it your sense that people in government and people at the UN look at this index?
Absolutely. Most of, obviously, we get a lot of attention from media, but we have been, every year we're routinely contacted by embassies here in Washington, D.C. and so on, and have, you know, ambassadors and, you know, deputy chiefs of mission and so on. They come over, and, you know, whether they're angry when they get in the door or they're not, generally they leave with having discussed, you know, why their state is on the list and what they can do to make it better. And certainly in the United States government, yes, we get a lot of calls, a lot of questions about how our analysis can better help policymaking.
Patricia Taft is a senior associate at the Fund for Peace, which, with Foreign Policy Magazine, has just released its 2008 Failed States Index. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
On tomorrow's show, Tony and Academy Award winner Mercedes Rule on her star turn in Edward Albee's Occupant. Also, a new documentary about Dalton Trumbo, one of Hollywood's highest paid screenwriters who was blacklisted. We'll celebrate the 20th anniversary of Zeitgeist Films with its founders and celebrated filmmaker Guy Maddin. Plus, Please Explain is all about solar power. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Sarah English, and Scott Goldberg. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Fran Jacobs, Barbara Kahn, Lauren Bonner, and Catherine Ident. Debbie Daughtry is at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening.